Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 11th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. And Gwen, you had a little car trouble, so you couldn't make it in, but we're glad we've got you on the phone. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Steve, and I hope that you don't hear a little meow in the background.
We welcome a little meow in the background. And I also should say that we've got some work going on outside the studio here in Woods Hole, some heavy machinery moving back and forth. If you hear some funny rumbling and beeping noises, that's what that is. Joining us from later on in the program, we'll hear from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Jim Kinsella of the Enterprise Newspapers, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. We'll speak with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Gwen, Cape Cod Times reporting this week a story about the home where Sergeant Sean Gannon was killed last month. Turns out that the owners had been trying to evict the tenants at the property for some time.
Yes, there are actually three stories this week about Sergeant Sean Gannon and the 32-year-old Yarmouth police canine officer who was shot to death April 12th. The first, as you say, had to do with the fact that the tenants at that house, Chelsea Bergen and Dale Thatcher Jr., they were living at 109 Blueberry Lane without permission and not paying $1,400 monthly rent, according to the owners, according to court papers filed by the owners, Paul and Lisa Fitzgerald. And they were preparing to have them evicted, and that actually finally happened officially on Tuesday. But it's still not clear, though, what their relationship, Bergen and Thatcher, might have been or not been to Thomas Latanowicz, and he is the 29-year-old Somerville man who's charged with Officer Gannon's death. He also charged in shooting, harming a police dog because Gannon's dog Nero was also shot.
And it sounds like from this article that the condition of the house right now is not very good, in part because of the police search that had to go on there.
And we learned a little more about that this week. Also, in another story, the police, I guess we could launch right into that story.
Sure. This is about details that came out this week about what happened in the house when Sergeant Gannon was killed.
Yes, and the details that we learned, you know, we've been kind of hearing things over this number of weeks, but the details that we learned from the officials on late yesterday afternoon had to do with the fact that they had cleared the house, you know, and found no one when they went to 109 Blueberry Lane, including going through a crawl space, like a little hole in the closet ceiling. And they had gone up there and found no one, but they found a couple of backpacks that had drugs and clothes in them. So they went back down, and then with some additional evidence, they decided to go back into the attic space, which Sergeant Gannon did, along with Nero and another officer. They noticed that there was a piece of insulation that was covering the space that went to to more room over an addition on the house. And when they pulled aside that insulation, Latanowicz was they found him hiding there, and he allegedly shot both Officer Gannon and Nero at the same time. The police took Gannon out and retreated, surrounded the house until Latanowicz surrendered. But then they did cut a hole in the roof because they were looking for the gun, and they did find it in four pieces hidden all over the house, you know, from a toilet up to in the insulation. So that was the kind of detail that was released this week.
And also the amount of money that he had, Latanowicz had in the house, I think was impressive. There's $25,000 or more.
Yes, that along with the drugs, and he is scheduled for a hearing later this month.
Now, Sergeant Gannon's dog, Nero, made a public appearance this week. The dog is recovering from being shot, as you say, in that same incident in which Gannon was killed last month.
Nero got a lot of attention when he visited with one of the former Yarmouth canine officers, Peter McClellan. And now Officer McClellan has been taking care of Nero, has had him at his house, and also knows him, you know, from his puppyhood when he first came to train. And in case anyone doesn't know, Nero is a 2.5-year-old Belgian Malinois. I think that's how you say it.
Malinois, yeah.
Well, I could be wrong, but they look very much like a German Shepherd, and he was alert and full of energy Friday, and sticking kind of close to his canine handlers. Some of the things we found out is that he is expected to return to work after he finishes his recovery, that he will be 100%, even though he still has a piece of a bullet lodged underneath his forepaw. And there was maybe the best way to experience this story is through the video that Jason Colnos shot. It's been hugely popular. A lot of people have been looking in to learn more about Nero and about his human handler. One of the things we found out was that Sergeant Gannon had actually renamed the dog when he started working with him from Giro to Nero because he just felt like it was a more natural fit, and so he had renamed the dog. There's some nice memories about their relationship as well.
Yeah, there's you mentioned in the article how Sean Gannon's wife Dara has visited Nero too recently, and the dog responded.
Yes, the dog was close to the Gannon family, beloved co-worker and pet, you know, so maybe pet's not quite the right word, but beloved co-worker, so the whole family, she was involved as well.
We're going to speak now with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. George, a report out this week looking at the Steamship Authority's ferry service. The numbers show what I think a lot of islanders already know, that it's been a year of unusual disruption for the ferry service.
It sure has. Let's start with some breaking news. Yesterday, the Steamship Authority has decided to hold its meeting on Martha's Vineyard on Tuesday at 4 o'clock at the high school in the Performing Arts Center, which is probably the biggest venue here.
The high school
island.
In the Performing Arts Center. So they're expecting a little crowd, huh?
Yes, yes. So this particular meeting had been scheduled for Nantucket, which is, you know, they move their meetings around for all of the port towns. And in this case, Nantucket is very difficult for Martha's Vineyard people to get to. And so that would be nearly impossible for people to attend. This meeting is going to be at 4 o'clock. Hopefully working people will be able to get there and have their say. And all of this goes back to some of the real troubles that the Steamship Authority has had in the first 4 months of 2018. A report released this week showed that 549 crossings had been missed between Vineyard Haven and Woods Hole since the start of the year. And just to put that into some perspective, the previous year there were 26 for the total year.
549 this year alone. Yeah,
that's right. And that's through April. So that doesn't include what happened just this past week, which precipitated people being outraged again at what's happening. The Martha's Vineyard backing out on Saturday night, about 5 o'clock, backing out of Woods Hole, lost power again. And this time there was some fear that it might hit a ledge that's there, because once it's without power, it can drift. And so the captain quickly dropped anchor. We have some audio of that on our website. And, you know, the captain was very distressed about what was happening, concerned a couple hundred people on board. But the ferry quickly regained power, and he was able to pull it back into the slip. The problem is, as you can see out your window there at WCA, there's a lot of construction going on down at the steamship terminal, and so only one slip, only the one slip was available. In the other, one of the other slips that might have been available was the Katama freight ferry that had broken down earlier in the week. So the two usable slips in Woods Hole had two ferries in them that couldn't be used, that were broken down. So two ferries had to turn around and go back to Vineyard Haven, unload their passengers, and for 3 to 4 hours, people were stranded on either side of the Sound, unable to go. This is a Saturday, a busy Saturday. May 5th, there was Chili Fest on the island. There was a big Derby event, Kentucky Derby event at the Harbor View. Countless other activities all across the island as Martha's Vineyard wakes up for the season. And so, you know, there were hundreds of people on both sides. We have some pretty telling pictures online as well. Of the crowds of people that had gathered in Vineyard Haven, the crowds of people that had gathered in Woods Hole. Luckily for the folks in Woods Hole, there was a little Cinco de Mayo party going on at Landfall and the Taqueria, and many people went over to that to pass the time. So just it's really, really stirred people here on the island. There is a Facebook page over here called Islanders Talk. That is just loaded, absolutely loaded with comments from people that are just fed up. Business people are saying, this is going to affect our business, as J.B. Blau told our reporter. You know, if a great white shark right now were to be seen off Martha's Vineyard, that might attract people to the island, unlike, you know, the fictional Jaws. But he's saying, this ferry issue could be the island's Jaws, because people are seeing the ferry as being unreliable. And are they going to make their plans to come to Martha's Vineyard, where it might be questionable if they can get over here? And if they get over here, can they get back? Or are they going to go somewhere else? Business owners are very concerned. He's been leading the charge. He got 1,000 likes within a few hours. We posted a survey on our weekly newsletter asking three simple questions. Overwhelmingly, people were saying that they have been inconvenienced by the ferry. And so very interesting feedback. And I want to stress again that this isn't, you know, some people from the outside look at this as people complaining about, you have to take a ferry to the island and you might be inconvenienced. This is more than an inconvenience. People are missing doctor's appointments. Fuel isn't getting here. You know, yesterday I was at a Martha's Vineyard Airport Commission meeting where they said we weren't able to get our jet fuel. So, you know, this has big, big implications if they can't get this straightened out with the busy season
George,
coming.
George, tell us one more time, remind us when the meeting is that's coming up then, the Steamship Authority.
That's on Tuesday, and it's at 4 o'clock, and it's at the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School in the Performing Arts Center.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for catching us up to date on that.
Hey, thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss, and on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, really interesting story, I thought, about Chatham Select Board members pressing the Cape's congressional representative, Bill Keating, to stand behind a bill that he introduced defending the town's interest in the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. And the congressman pushing right back. Explain this for us.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. The selectmen here are very upset that this federal legislation, which would reset the boundary of the refuge to the low tide line, has been languishing in Congress. And this week, they accused Keating of listening to, and this is a quote, the sweet siren song of national environmental groups that oppose this legislation. Those groups see this as a loss of federal protection over sensitive habitat. Now, as you know, Steve, we've talked about this a couple of times, but just as a brief background, the Fish and Wildlife Service, in their recent comprehensive plan for Monomoy, took jurisdiction over about 4,000 acres of water and submerged land in Nantucket Sound west of the refuge. This is an area that both the town and state have been overseeing for decades, maybe centuries, and town and state officials kind of said, wait a minute, we've been good stewards of this resource, and we don't really trust the federal government to allow us to continue what we've been doing. So thus the legislation that Keating agreed to file, which would roll back the boundary of the federal refuge to the low tide line. Now, the legislation was reported favorably by the Republican-led House Committee on Natural Resources back in September. And at that point, it became one of really what apparently are hundreds of other bills waiting for a vote. And Keating said he blamed the House leadership for the delay in getting this bill and many other bills up for a vote. He said, of course, that he isn't under any pressure from any environmental groups and that he sponsored the legislation and, of course, favors it. But he kind of indicated to us that his hands are tied. Selectmen, though, they're frustrated over the fact that they say Keating hasn't been responsive to them, and that they say he's not doing enough to lobby for the bill. Board member Dean Nicastro even suggested that the town enlist a Republican congressman from another state who might be more sympathetic to the town's plight to kind of get the bill through. And the board also issued a call to action for residents, requesting that folks in town here contact Keating's office and use social media to press for a vote on the bill. They posted a packet of information to this effect on the town's website, and a number of people have done this. We've been seeing it pop up on social media, and we'll see what kind of impact it has on the legislative process.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for that.
Thank you, Steve.
With us now in the studio is Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Stephen.
And Jim, you have a story about school start times. They're going to change in Mashpee. This is something that many school districts across the region have looked at. Tell us what Mashpee has in mind.
Well, Steve, what Mashpee's proposing, or not actually proposing, what they in fact are going to do, and this will start not this coming September, but the following September, that would be September of 2019, that school year, they're basically proposing that the students attending the middle school and high school, they're going to be going to school about an hour later than they are right now. They are currently going in around 7:30. Under this new plan, they'll be going in around 8:30. Now, conversely, the younger students in Mashpee, and this goes from pre-K, up through some of the elementary grades, they're going to be going to school later. Excuse me, they're going to be going to school earlier. Right now, they get in there around 9 o'clock, and, you know, they're now going to have to go to school. Basically, you know, they're going to have to get into school earlier, I think more in the 8:20 range. So a lot of controversy and contention over this. This has been going on basically for about a year and a half or 2 years. And again, as you mentioned, it sort of comes from this idea that adolescents really need sleep. And studies have looked at this and they said just some more sleep. If you can get adolescents more sleep, they're going to perform better in school. It's going to be better for them. The trick is, how do you do that and yet balance the needs of some of the younger students? The other thing coming into play here, Steve, is that families obviously set up their schedules on bus schedules, and, you know, they need to have care for their children. Does this now, for example, if this younger students have to stay at the house later, will working parents be able to accommodate that? If so, how? The school committee said, yes, we understand there's going to be impact to this. But Nicole Bartlett, who's one of the school committee members, she says, well, you know, we've got like 16 months here between now and when it goes into effect. And, you know, we want to work with our parents and our families to to try to make this work as best we can. But the vote was 4-1 to go in this direction.
Jim Kinsella from the Mashpee, speaking from an article in the Mashpee Enterprise. Jim, thanks for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, Steve.
We have Gwen Friss on the phone with us from the Cape Cod Times. And Gwen, the developers of Mashpee Commons are pursuing plans to expand and build housing. Tell us, what do they have in mind?
Well, the latest development in this is that they've been meeting for months with neighbors and town officials trying to craft something that is, welcomed by everyone. And the latest that they're looking at is to get a change in the zoning bylaw where they are so that they can have a blend of housing, some of it affordable housing, and new businesses. On Wednesday, 100 community members were on hand when they when the preliminary sketches were shown at Mashpee Commons. And as I said, they've been looking for a give and take of information. The current zoning bylaw does not allow for housing at in the area where Mashpee Commons is located. So the developers are looking instead at a what's called a form-based code for future expansion, and it favors scale, mass, and placement of buildings in the development area rather than the general zoning bylaw that's in effect now. So there's not a commitment from the town for that yet. We still have to see how that's going to play out. And this, what they're talking about, there are actually several phases to the project. So they had actually just opened 22 housing units, and they've completed those, and they are now looking at 10 one-bedroom units under this new phase of development. The altogether, 67 housing units have been built, and the Mashpee Commons Master Plan calls for the creation of 382 units in accordance with the state's affordable housing laws. But on Wednesday, the Mashpee Commons spokesman were saying that might not be economically feasible.
And Gwen, tell us about the feeling in the community about this expansion of housing into Mashpee Commons.
It's been mixed, but largely positive. People who have been in these sessions have asked for a few things, including more green space, more affordable housing, and parking and bike trails in the new development. Now, there are some members of the community, for example, some of the folks of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, who have bigger concerns, for example, where the development itself would go, because one of the tribe members, David Whedon, was saying that the Commons owns property right up to the Quashnet River, and he was concerned that the build-out not infringe on that ecosystem.
We're going to speak with Casey Myers right now at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Gwen. How you doing?
Good morning, Casey.
Casey, you have a story this week in the Provincetown Banner about a trip you took through Wellfleet, but it's one that you can only do, it sounds like, at this time of year. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is a strange departure for me and my husband, Eric. We took a 5-mile kayak trip through the usually very inaccessible Herring River. We started at Gull Pond, which is the largest kettle pond in Wellfleet, and we basically we went the opposite way that the herring are going to spawn. We went down the river all the way to Wellfleet Harbor. It took us 4 hours. We got extremely muddy, extremely cold, but it was the most beautiful view of Wellfleet that we'd never seen before, even though we've lived in that small town for 20 years. And it's just, let's see, we saw a swan on her nest. We saw a duck blind, which you don't usually think of this area as a big hunting area, but it's like I said, it's a completely different perspective of this beautiful area. We saw marsh reeds, we saw fiddleheads, we saw heron. We went under footpaths that you would never come upon before. We lost track of where we were for what seemed like at least an hour. We just didn't recognize anything. It was just all this mysterious marshland. And then we got back to our familiar grounds where we'd parked our second car after 4 hours, and we started in fresh water at about 10 in the morning, and by 1 in the afternoon, we were in salt water. It was very, very interesting. We went from ducking brambles and briars, and my husband got hit with a bramble and his glasses got knocked off and into the black water. You had to fish him out. Very lucky he found them.
And part of the reason that this is possible is because of the time of year, is that right? Or how much water, rain we've had?
That's right. The spring is the time for the highest water. So we were able to make it even the driest part of the route, which is up near the ponds, the high north part of the river. And so this is going to go away probably in the next few weeks, depending on rain. So we were very fortunate to have this beautiful view. We watched fiddleheads uncurl along the shore and just saw thousands of herring coming in the other direction. It was just quite magical and quite an adventure.
And the inspiration for this, tell us about the inspiration for taking this trip.
Oh, the inspiration is Walter Rowell, who was a 21-year-old selectman's candidate. And this guy just exudes joy about Wellfleet. He loves Wellfleet so much. And during the interview, he said, oh, yeah, you got to do this. It's the best. And I just couldn't get it out of my head as soon as he said it. I just had to do it. He lives right near Gull Pond. So this is something that he's done quite a few times. It was magical. Very magical. Highly recommended.
And some nice photos that go along with that. Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, I want to ask you about, there were many town meetings this week across the Cape. Three towns approved a partnership between them that will allow them to explore options for regional wastewater treatment. Tell us a little about this.
I will jump right back into the news, Steve, but I must say that Casey's description was so lyrical, I got pretty relaxed there.
That's fine. Now,
okay, back to work. Dennis is the third and final partner to commit to the DHY Clean Waters Community Partnership, and that is exploring options for wastewater, treating wastewater from Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth. And they're going to be working together now. The vote was not unanimous. There was a lone voice dissenting, but the partnership was approved, and it stands to save the towns a combined $100 million in construction costs by continuing work on a plan that would treat wastewater from all three towns at one central facility in Dennis. The partnership will attempt to finalize the plan and in the next year, and once completed, it would have to go back to town meeting and require approval by each town's board of selectmen. So this is a step in a process, and it would be something that we'd be seeing again at next year's town meeting, hopefully.
And Gwen, another story out this week I want to talk about, which is an injured snowy owl, which was found and is now recovering at a wildlife rehab center. Tell us a little bit about this.
This sounds almost like a children's book. I learned a lot in this story, but the owl was found by a busy street in New Bedford Animal Control Center, and they brought it down to the Cape for care at the Cape Wildlife Center. They are theorizing that it was probably hit by a car, and it has one of its wings has a broken bone. But interestingly, and I never knew this, the veterinarian at WildCare, Dr. Priya Patel, was saying that the snowy owl has two bones that run parallel. So while its ulna is healing through, I guess it'll be about 4 weeks, it's simply, you don't have to splint it or anything because the other bone acts as a natural splint for it. So that was pretty interesting. And snowy owls spend summers north of the Arctic Circle, and they eat as many as 1,600 lemons in a single yeah, I know, not lemons. Who wouldn't do well with that? In a single year, that's according to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. So it's a story where we find out that the owl is doing pretty well because someone picked him up and brought him in, and also learned some snowy owl facts.
And at some point, they're going to release the owl. They hope for it to fly back north, right?
Yes, and they're going to try and do that on the northernmost piece of either Mass Audubon or state land that they can find to kind of give it a little push in the right direction.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Gwen Frist. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. There's more in a moment. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me on the phone is Gwen Frist from the Cape Cod Times. And also on the phone with us right now is Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, the story everybody on the island seems to be talking about has to do with the ferry service and with the very hard year that the steamship has had mm-hmm. so far. We talked about this earlier in the hour as well, and really we focused on what's gone wrong. I want to ask you about, there's a lot of talk about what happens next. How do the Steamship Authority address this so that it doesn't continue going forward? I mean, it's everything that's happened has happened yeah. in a very quiet season, and I think people look at mm-hmm. the summer coming as well and wonder what happens if something Absolutely. Like these ferry breakdowns happen in the middle of the summer.
Absolutely. That is definitely the discussion that's happening right now with island residents and local officials and business people, where this has really reached the point that there's concern. Not only, you know, now it's a problem, but we're seeing more Memorial Day just a few weeks away, so it's reaching a point where people say this isn't tenable. Something needs to happen. And as you heard, there was a successful call to move next week's Steamship Authority Board of Governors meeting to the Vineyard from Nantucket. The other real call for action has been for an independent investigation into what's going on. And this came up after that series of breakdowns in March that went on for several weeks. And the Vineyard's the representative to the Board of Governors, Mark Hanover, he called at that time for an outside consultant to come in and look at things and come up with a plan of action. And this came up at the meeting in April, which was also on the Vineyard. And the board heard this idea. And the Steamship Authority also has a proposal from McKinsey & Company, a management consulting firm in Boston, that outlines their areas of concern and a program that they suggest implementing. But it has a $500,000 price tag,
mm-hmm.
And most of the other board members said, you know, they acknowledge if there is a problem, it needs to be looked at, but they said that they didn't think it was necessary to take on the expense of hiring this outside firm. They said if there was a huge problem internally, they would know it. It's a matter of fine-tuning what they have, and that they would rather have it done in-house. So the call, you know, to immediately hire them then was put on hold, and Bob Davis, the Steamship Authority general manager, he came up with this kind of alternative plan that he's going to propose next week. But, of course, now steamship problems are back front and center, and there's clearly this loss of patience and concern about the summer season. So that's really renewed the call for the outside consultant. And the Oak Bluffs Board of Selectmen actually sent a letter this week backing Mr. Hanover's proposal for an outside consultant. I've heard there might be other boards of selectmen on the island that might support that too. And we heard a lot about the report that came out this week detailing the, you know, really high numbers of boat cancellations this year. And this is the report that Mr. Davis has come up as kind of the alternative to the McKinsey proposal, that something, the way to look forward internally. So he outlined, you know, the extremely high number of cancellations. The other real area that they're looking at improvement is communication. That's been another issue through all of this, is getting the information out to passengers through the website, through emails. Sometimes it's, you know, doesn't come or it comes really late. So they're looking at a plan to improve communications generally by hiring a communication manager. And the report also takes a look at a pretty cumbersome internal system for getting information out that For example, that most recent incident last Saturday mm-hmm. when the Martha's Vineyard lost power and didn't run for several hours and people were stranded on both sides, that information didn't go out to the public on the Steamship Authority website for about an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And so that was a cause for concern. And apparently agents and ticket sellers are responsible for updating the current status and standby information on the website. But, of course, whenever there's a big disruption to service, they're really busy with customer service issues and people right there. So that makes it hard for them to do both of those things. So that's another area of concern that would presumably be looked at either by an outside consultant or if the Steamship Authority decides to do this internally, they would do that from within. But I expect this will be a major topic of discussion next week when they meet here on the Vineyard.
And tell us one more time, remind us where and when that meeting is.
Yeah, the meeting is Tuesday, and it's from 4 to 6. And it's at the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School Performing Arts Center.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Gwen Frist from the Cape Cod Times. Sandwich had a town election yesterday. The big issue on the ballot was approving money to repair the boardwalk. Tell us what happened.
Sandwich voters did approve that money. It was an $8 million debt exclusion to the Proposition 2.5 tax cap. And that happened yesterday. And what it covers is a complete rebuild of the Sandwich Boardwalk, including bringing it up to ADA Americans with Disabilities standards by installing a railing along the side. The other six, this is going to be a $2 million project. The other $6 million is slated for the town's crumbling, what was described as the town's crumbling infrastructure. And the vote was 1,065 to 856, and that represents about 13% of Sandwich's registered voters.
Hmm.
And imagine, Steve, that you want me to quickly run the numbers for you. Average homeowner can expect to pay an additional $948 over 15 years, and that starts with $76 the first year and sinks to $51 by the 15th year.
Another story out of Sandwich this week, an effort to bring artist shacks to the town, has been meeting some opposition.
It has. I'm just shuffling papers quietly here. The effort is being run by the Sandwich Economic Initiative Corps, a state-chartered economic development group of volunteers from Sandwich business community. But last Friday, the Sandwich Chamber of Commerce, the board of directors voted not to support the seasonal arts concept, and the chamber officials were saying that they are concerned that it will take away from local businesses to have that seasonal series of artist shanties, because people would be selling their art there and other things. There's a similar concept at work in Hyannis, and people get together, they paint, they show off their work, and they sell it there. So the chamber voted against that. The space we're talking about is down at the Sandwich Marina by the Pilot House restaurant. That's where they would be if they are able to garner support to do that, because they need support of the chamber and local business community mm-hmm. in order to go forward.
We're going to speak right now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com and New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, you've got a pair of stories doing well online, not very happy stories. Both have to do with robberies, but not necessarily a lot of money at stake. But the circumstances around these have gotten the attention. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so these were two crime-related stories. They got under the skin of people in South Coast, not because they're, high-profile crimes or a big money involved, but because the victims in the cases were children, and in another case, they were churchgoers. So on Wednesday in New Bedford, this thief stole the collections from a group that was singing and playing music at the Unitarian Church. Members of the parish, they were practicing sea shanties. They do that every Wednesday night. And when they practice, some listen to the music. The group takes up a collection to pay for the church building rental. And so along comes an opportunistic thief. It's not known whether he knew the group's routine, but he did take advantage of what he saw. So people at the building say he came in, said hello, and then he left the building. But he made note of the collection basket that he saw, and he returned to the church moments later, grabbed the money, and ran out the door. Some of the parishioners chased him. The musicians ran out to try to get him, but he escaped with, not a lot of money, but about $80. But it's just that, the place that he stole it from, a church, that makes it, a heinous kind of a crime. So police responded to the scene. They didn't get the guy, and he's got the $80, and the churchgoers are out their money. So there was another story, too. It's one of these heartless thief stories, and this was in nearby Acushnet. And this theft, it ruined the plans of some young dance students who'd been raising money all year for this competition that they were going to go to in the summer. And over the weekend, the thief smashed into the front door window at the Broadway School of Dance. He entered the building, and then he rummaged through the offices until he found the donations, which totaled $3,200. The children and their parents had been raising that money for a dance competition in July. They've been having monthly fundraisers, spaghetti dinners, a trip to Foxwood, bake sales. The thief also stole from an adjacent pet business, too. So he was caught on video surveillance cameras, but they still haven't found him yet, and they're urging him to turn himself in. So the kids are out the money, and they were trying to raise $5,000 to attend this competition. It's in New Hampshire. And they set up a GoFundMe page, too. So,
and you do have that video on your website. You can see the fellow rummaging around looking for the money.
Yeah, and it's you can see them running through the building, looking, opening all the drawers. It's quite a long time that they were on video, and I'm not sure whether they'll be recognized, but it is available. The story and the video are both on our website. So that's at southcoasttoday.com.
Andy Tomalonis of southcoasttoday.com, New Bedford Standard Times. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Gwen Friss is with us from the Cape Cod Times. And Gwen, the town of Barnstable put together a large sale of foreclosed properties. The town officials seem happy with the money that the sale has raised.
They sold 23 properties, and it raised just about $500,000. The town also points out that these real estate transactions will generate together, the 23 of them, an additional $10,000 to $11,000 a year in tax revenue because they weren't being paid before, so this is going to keep on giving. It's kind of an interesting look when you see the sales, because most of them are between a quarter and a third of an acre, and they're not buildable spots. So a lot of them went to the abutters who are already there, who were adding to their land. And the minimum bids on the properties range from $500 to $2,500. So the town said that they were pretty happy with how it worked out.
And it looks like they're going to do this again going forward with another group of properties. Let's talk about an annual count of the homeless, which is taking steps to make sure it counts young people. It takes some extra effort to get a count on the younger people in the homeless population.
There were concerns that that population was being underreported, because only 5 out of 74 CAPE respondents aged 16 to 24 met the criteria for homelessness during last year's Massachusetts youth count. So this year, the Homeless Prevention Council is enlisting the Cape Cod Community College, and the Hyannis Youth and Community Center is asking for their help in reaching out to homeless youth so there's a better count. The college, this can happen in a couple of ways. Schools, colleges are required by federal law to keep account of homeless students, so there's a sort of a systemic way of looking at it, but also just in talking to people. The volunteers from the Community Leadership Institute at Cape Cod Community College said they set up a table in the cafeteria, and they talked to, quote, at least 30 young people who seem to be experiencing housing issues, and that can be anything from you know, their living situation being couch surfing to them living in their cars. So this is expected to get a more accurate count, and the Council to Prevent Homelessness said they already have placed one of those people in a program that is leading to a house for him.
And one of the things that happens here I found interesting in the article is that sometimes young people stay behind to complete high school while the parents have to leave to search for work or to get work elsewhere, or they leave the Cape area for better housing options.
Yes, I found that interesting, too, because it's that age group where people are finishing high school and, you know, starting jobs or starting college.
We heard about this week about the upswing in interest in kelp growing. We had a story on our air. Cape Cod Times had a story. There's some farmers in Chatham who are pursuing this. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, I must confess that I've never cooked anything with kelp, and that is part of what's coming up in this story.
You are the food editor, right?
Yeah, I know, Steve, but I'm getting there. So to tell you a little bit about what's happening, it seems that both here and in Oak Bluffs, people involved in this are fishermen who were concerned about the limits and the laws that the fishing industry is experiencing, decided to look for another way to basically make a living from the ocean. So the company here in Chatham is with Jamie Bassett, Carl Douglas, and Richard Curtis. They are all Chatham fishermen, and they want to open a large kelp farm off Harding Beach in Chatham. The trio's company is called Chatham Kelp, and they're doing a couple of things. They've won approval from local boards, and they're now applying for permits from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Division of Marine Fisheries to have three sites in Nantucket Sound. And they hope to have as many as 350 lines of kelp growing there. The other side of this is to develop your market, and some of it already exists. They're planning to grow sugar kelp, as do most of the growers in the state, but they can be used for a multitude of things, including food, fertilizer, and beauty products. I have seen a lot of kelp-based beauty products out there lately,
mm-hmm.
and they're working with chefs as well to develop recipes that can actually feature kelp.
Did it catch your interest for cooking with kelp?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it on its own, it's not too attractive to look at. Sorry, guys, but you know, in things, I'm sure that it would be a good thing. I actually don't know. You know, I have the feeling that it would be nutritious. I'd have to look it up to get the details on that.
Gwen, I want to touch on one more story before we go, and it has to do with plans for students from the mainland to be able to attend school on Cuttyhunk and how these plans seem to have fallen through. But it sounded like it had the potential to be a great opportunity.
It did, and what's sort of interesting is that Cuttyhunk has a single schoolhouse. You know, it covers grades kindergarten to 8, and it
let me jump in and say, for folks who don't know, Cuttyhunk, an island at the end of the Elizabeth Islands chain.
It's yes, thank you.
Very remote.
I made that assumption. You know, thanks for adding that. And it's very remote, and that's part of the problem. That they had two students last year. The older one is graduating eighth grade, so it's only his sister who is left. So the town the school system looked at doing, quote, a semester on Cuttyhunk, close quote. Beautiful place, by the way. You know, you can take the boat over from New Bedford or from the Cape. Very nice place. But what happened was several people expressed interest in sending their children to the Cuttyhunk one-room schoolhouse. But the problem was more around the transfer of school funds and other parameters involved in, you know, like state funding for schools and that kind of thing. So the program, although the program was seen as a way to inject new mm-hmm. ideas and new students, they decided that it would not be a workable one.
Mm-hmm. That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us, Steve.
And thanks to all my other contributors we heard from across the region. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.